Okay, so today's Q&A. So we have a few left over to from yesterday. What can I do to stop judging? For example, when looking at the list of food people will bring to a gathering, instantly think why she brings that or how come he always provides good food. Thank you, Bhante. As bottom line Buddhist practice, suffering. It's just such a complication to be judging, and why it's Dear Lumpa. Just pay attention to the suffering and let that go. Dear Lumpa, thank you for your talk today. You mentioned giving the opportunity for everyone to practice and train. However, there seems to be no Ajahn Chah monasteries in U.S. and Canada where women can ordain and train. Would Abhayagiri be open to having a female monastic community at some point in the future? One of the things, and I actually mentioned that we began without an idea to have provide that opportunity for ordination, mainly because of coming from Thailand, from the Ajahn Chah tradition, it's very conservative, and it ends up being difficult. One of the things we made a point of doing is helping to provide support and encouragement for communities that are training women. Say, like tomorrow, the Dhammadrini community will be coming, and that's been an ongoing relationship for a long time. Since they're establishing, just recently I went down to help the Karuna Buddhist Vihara, myself and Ajahn Yaniko, to help them out in their establishing of their community, so that trying to give encouragement and support in that way. We in England, they have the Siladhara community, it's a very good standard of training. It's a very good opportunity, but I think it's much more difficult for that to be accepted here in America. And in fact, there was a beginning attempt to do that, but because it's not a full bhikkhuni ordination, then it ran into problems and difficulties. So that I'm happy to support communities that are developing, but I'm also keen to support the female monastic communities that are autonomous, as opposed to having, say, like a community that is like dual communities. So that's where I am and where we are these days. And we've been trying to encourage that training, and also there's been women who have been practicing and training here who have gone to other places in order to train, and we encourage that and try to support as best we can. I'm trying to keep it fairly, that sense of having autonomous communities. Okay, the next one, 11. I remember reading in one of Ajahn Chah's books about comparing our feeling to a snake. A sadness, unhappiness at its head, happiness as its tail, and how we should not touch it, any part of its body. My question is, how do we go about investigating our natural state of mind when we encounter this snake or our feelings on a daily basis? In other words, how can we just watch it comes in and out of our mind without interacting with it or getting influenced by it? Again, it comes back to dukkha and suffering, in that sense because it isn't as if, we just set an intention. Oh, I'm going to watch this come in and out of my mind, and I'm not going to get influenced by it. It affects us, and we go up and down in various ways, in our moods and our impressions. And what does that feel like? What does that, are we willing to learn from our experience? Can we give ourselves the opportunity to understand so the benefits and drawbacks of both, say, happiness and unhappiness, because it's not as if it's absolutely one or the other. Okay, so then we'll go to the questions that were from here, from the question bowl. What is the meaning of the inscription on the Buddha statue behind you? And that is Buddha Abhayagiri Shakyamuni. So it's common to when one commissions a Buddha image to be made, say whether it's casting it or carving it, like this one was carved, then to request the a respected elder to give it a name. It's an auspicious naming that. So this one was given to us by Ajahn Jundi. He gave this, and then the Buddha in the hall, which is our first Buddha image that we had commissioned for Abhayagiri, that one was cast, and it was the name was given by the former Sangharaja. A sense of, oh, next question, a sense of causeless joy permeates awareness, yet there remains a sense of a me that experiences. How to dissolve that? I think one of the things is to experience the limitation that we do experience when we feel we have to dissolve it. You know, it's like, I got to do something about this. It's reeks of me. and so then it's perpetuated. So it's that sense of just feeling the limitation, feeling the cramping of the joy and the awareness that comes with me. It's just being able to recognize that, and then there's a quite a natural inclination to relax or release around that. Ajahn, please explain why the monks keep the eyes closed during meditation. What is the practice? How about with open eyes or half open? Is it the same practice? I think a lot of it is personal preference. It's not mandated, and then also it can be adjusted, adapted to different times. Personally, I keep my eyes closed. It's a way of limiting the tendency to go to the sense door and to turn inwards. It's a helpful aid in collecting awareness or collecting attention, so that one doesn't get drawn out too much. Sometimes, especially if one's meditating at night or meditating with, this morning I talked about hindrances, and being able to recognizing, okay, maybe dullness sleepiness is coming up. So then it's helpful to either half open the eyes or open the eyes. Just that added impingement helps to keep the mind alert. Or it could be just the hindrance of restlessness, and closing the eyes helps to that. So it's just having options in one's toolkit of working with the mind and working with the hindrances. How do you recognize when craving has arisen? I mean, one of the things that tends to happen with craving is just there's an energy there that is either that feeling of unfulfilled or that feeling of seeking, that feeling of movement. And that's a helpful sign to pay attention to when you're saying, oh, because oftentimes it's unformed. I mean, it's easy when it's got a clear object and it's okay, that's craving, but oftentimes it's especially when it's a bit subtle, then it's more it's that movement of mind that seeking that and so it's looking for an object. So then you that is the craving itself, the actual movement. When practicing letting go, is there any particular order in doing so? For example, if I am attached to career, friends, and family, in order of increasing attachment, should I first let go of career, least attachment, then let go of friends, higher attachment, finally let go of family, highest attachment? Or does order of letting go not matter, and I can randomly pick letting go of something different each day? It's wherever it arises, you let it go there. In the same way that wherever a fire bursts out, that's where you squirt your fire extinguisher. I mean, it doesn't have to be in any particular order. It's sort of wherever kind of defilements, attachment arise, that's where you work with it. If everything in life is great and I am enjoying my life, why practice? What could get better? Okay, fine. What could get better is that you could actually become peaceful and wise. that could be better. And in a sense, and also that say practice isn't just for say the making your life better in a sense. I mean, that's a knock-on effect, but it's for the cultivation of qualities that have both an effect in the present, but into the future, so that the cultivation of virtue or integrity, the cultivation of generosity and patience, or cultivation of mindfulness and discernment, those are all qualities that have a benefit in the present, have a benefit into the future. We develop those fundamental character qualities. It also has the sense of, say, practice is not just for something, say, for this life, because there's a recognition that this life is also fraught with the limitation of aging, of illness, of death, of separation from everything that we know and we're familiar with, and there is a fundamental aspect of right view in a Buddhist perspective is that there is this life, there is a future life, there is a next life. And preparing for that, preparing for the ending of this life, preparing for a future life in a way that one is creating the conditions for a continuity of clarity and understanding. So that's an important element. So it works on many levels. How do you feel the holes? How do you feel good without the need for anything external/addictions? In other words, coping mechanisms. How do you deal with and move past what lies underneath these mechanisms? And I think that's one of the things, that's what, say, like, yeah, mindfulness and reflection and wisdom is for understanding how those fundamental, you know, mechanisms of coping, the fundamental mechanisms of being able to either deflect difficult feelings or to be overwhelmed by difficult feelings, experiences, to be distracted by desires and attachments. So it's so much of practice is learning how to pay attention to being willing to look a bit more deeply than the surface experience. And that's why the Buddha's brilliance in using dukkha as a tool to recognize not just sort of feelings of overwhelming suffering, but just feelings of just niggling stress, niggling dis-ease, boredom. So all of the things that are, you know, they're not, I mean, it's not life-threatening or earth-shattering to be bored, but it's a symptom of that, or a slight agitation. There's all those, that willingness to look at the range of our emotion and experience and try to reflect and understand it more clearly. Should we consider the Brahmaviharas a form of emotion, or are they kinds of knowledge or understanding? I wouldn't consider an either or situation. I mean, they are a form of emotion in a sense, and that's one of the teachers in our tradition uses, say, translate the Brahmaviharas, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, as mature emotions. And that's a very, very, that's a really valid way of looking at it. But they're also a kind of knowledge and understanding that allows a response of kindness or compassion or joy or equanimity, because one has a certain understanding of one's own mind and of the world around one. So then it's not an either or answer. I've got one here, specifically addressed to Ajahn Yaniko, but if you want, I can answer it. It's pretty simple. Yeah, okay. This one's addressed to Ajahn Yaniko, but I got the floor today, so I'll steal his thunder today. Can you please talk more about the three happinesses and what should we be careful about? So that those, it was from a question the other day that Ajahn Yaniko answered about the three happinesses that are in the it's in the dedication of merit, blessing, sharing of blessings, chant, and it's the like present happiness or worldly happiness, heavenly happiness, and the happiness of Nibbana. So those and I think one of the things is that the Buddha is makes an important point in the sense of we should be attending, we should be careful about cultivating and developing all the different forms of happiness that we can do. Not in a kind of searching through desire and attachment and clinging and compulsion, but recognizing that there is happiness in all the different elements of our, say, of our life of practice and living a skillful life. And it's really important to attend to those forms of happiness. So that, say, this morning I talked about the working with the five hindrances in meditation, but to view them as the a doorway or a natural way of creating happiness, because we step back from obstructions in the mind, stepping back from desire, ill wills, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, skeptical doubt, and the Buddha said there's a happiness that comes, the keeping of precepts and having a sense of integrity and virtue in our life is a basis of happiness, both in terms of personal happiness of thing and then also social happiness, where we have our social relations are really a source of well-being. And so, and then you think in terms of heavenly happiness, just refining the degrees of happiness that we have, and the happiness of not clinging to anything at all, the happiness of Nibbana. Okay, we get to today's questions from the Zoom people. I have loaned something to my brother and he just won't give it back to me, no matter how many times I ask him. How would you approach this situation? How should I handle this? You could just give up. That's a way but it also depends what it is. Sometimes you have to take into account what's underlying it, in terms of can one, rather than just pestering them about what you've loaned, starting a conversation about what's underlying it? What's the reason? Is there some sort of reason? Is there some? Does he have some kind of? Does he have some kind of difficulty that he's not willing to give it back? Does he even have it? Has he lost it? There's all sorts of so just even starting a conversation as to so that might get a better understanding of what the situation is. So there's that sense, just giving up on it and forgetting about it. That's one way, or starting a conversation, or being very aggressive. Take them to court. That's very American. You can do. You've got a whole range of options, but what is it that's going to actually be useful for oneself? Because if it's something that is really important to you, then you have to figure out a skillful way to address the situation. Getting in somebody's face is usually not a good way to find resolution. Reflecting on how to approach it skillfully, that's something to be considering. And sort of, how should I handle this in a black and white, right and wrong way, but what kind of outcome am I hoping for? Because there's the outcome of actually getting whatever you loan, but then there's also outcome in terms of relationship with a family member, and those are important considerations, and they might be at odds with each other. So it's reflecting on that a bit more thoroughly or skillfully, and then identifying, say, what outcome one would like, and then say, well, what kind of approach is actually needed, and how to work with it so that particular outcome might arise. Okay, next one. Have you ever suffered from some sort of addiction, and how did you recover from it? What would be your advice to some suffering from an addiction? I guess I wasn't in the world long enough to have a real addiction. I ended up in a monastery pretty young, so, and even the minor addiction that I did have was smoking cigarettes. I mean, that's an addiction, and they're just not in the monastery, so they weren't there. It was didn't have to think about it. Which is not that's not much advice. but I would one of the things I would certainly in terms of addiction, I would and on a certain level, as human beings, we are addicted to all sorts of things, and even if you're in a monastery. There's kind of addictive personalities, and our addictions to sense gratification, addiction to affirmation of self. Those are, they're refined, but those are addictions, and I think one of the things that say advice. For somebody suffering from an addiction, and especially if it's it is suffering that it's important to seek the help and support of others, in the sense that say AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, provides really good. So I mean, they've got decades and decades of experience dealing with alcoholism and support systems and mentors and that's it's having others to help to support, help to reflect back to us, help to give us encouragement. So that's that sense of reaching out to others in the Buddhist world. There's a movement, a refuge recovery, which is using, because sometimes they like AA, they use a theistic model, which is a bit not so comfortable for some people. So then using some of those aspects, but also using the traditional forms of Buddhist practice to help support people who do have addictions, and using recovery, using refuges and the tools of a Buddhist practice, which is really skillful. But so the main thing, I think, is seeking out and reaching out to others who do have experience and who do have difficulty, because it's, especially with addiction, one of the helpful supports is people who have gone through something similar to oneself. They will both be, tend to be empathetic and supportive, and they'll also, because they've been through it, they've seen it, they can oftentimes call you on your kind of obfuscations because that's one of the things, addictive personality is, it's just looking around for, it gets, looking for any angle to justify and seek a gratification. So it's being called on that, and it's really helpful. Having somebody who will actually point out ways that one is getting lost. So yeah, reaching out to people is really important. I'd say on a so those are groups. I'm sure on so that's a skillful way, but also finding that in terms of one's own motivation. I mean, addiction is looking for something that is, I mean, we are gratifying. So then turning to reflection and investigating, well, what is actually, say, a more satisfying experience of well-being and happiness that doesn't have the complications of the object of addiction. So that's something, is paying attention to the happiness and well-being. And certainly the Dhamma practice is really helpful for that. Could you please explain how one practices applied and sustained thought in breath meditation, vitakka vichara? Thank you. An easy way of applying is just basically referring to Ajahn Chah, who would say, like, vitakka is like the lifting up of attention to the sensation of the breath. That's vitakka, the lifting up of attention. And vichara is the sustained thought around the experience. So then one lifting up attention to the experience, vichara, looking at it from different angles so that one gets a sustained perspective on the breath. Inevitably, one gets distracted. Then it's vitakka again. You use that vitakka to lift up the attention to the breath. And then so it's like using that vitakka vichara to work with the breath and mindfulness. It's 4:29. I'll take a easy question. There'll be a couple questions left over. Venerable Ajahn, can you please explain why the Ajahn holds a fan in front of him during the taking of refuges? Thank you. So that's in some monasteries. Very rarely do we do that here. But there is...
Katina's the only time we ever do that.
Maybe Katina's the only time. But even then, it's oftentimes that's during the Katina chant as opposed to the...
People are looking at the sides of us. Look, we're just hiding from each other.
Right. You're hiding so you can have the chanting behind the fan.
Put the chanting on the background.
Anyway, in traditional or classical Theravada countries, when an Ajahn is giving refuges and precepts. And also it used to be even giving a Dhamma talk. The purpose of using a fan, oftentimes there's a symbol or a little Dhamma saying on those fans. They're ceremonial fans. And a lot of it, as I understand it, is that those were ways of keeping the position of the elder impersonal, so that the person was a representative of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, was a representative of the religion rather than, say, an individual, a personality who was either giving a talk and similar with the the Pritta chanting would often be that as well. Certainly the funeral ceremonies, like in formal, again it's in, oftentimes it's in Bangkok monasteries where there'd be the funeral chanting and they'll use the fan in front. So it's a lot of it is to keep it from personalizing the presence and encouraging the sense of as a representative of the religion or the Dhamma, as opposed to any individual. That's how I understand it. Okay, 4:32.